his writing that he died in 19, I don't know where the 1948 comes from, but his dying that he died in 1948 doesn't really get fact checked until the miniseries comes out.
And then, of course, it gets really popular.
It gets really popular and his family sees it. And this is in the miniseries. It says it at the end. Blythe dies in 1948. His family will see this and be like, hold up. No, he's not.
Welcome to Talk with History. I am your host, Scott, here with my wife and historian, Jen.
Hello.
On this podcast, we give you insights to our history-inspired world travels, YouTube channel journey, and examine history through deeper conversations with the curious, the explorers, and the history lovers out there. Today, we're heading back to hallowed ground, Arlington National Cemetery, one last time. We're on a mission to honor some real-life heroes, the men of Easy Company, immortalized in the book and miniseries Band of Brothers. From jumping into occupied France on D-Day to braving the brutal winter offensive in the Battle of the Bulge, these soldiers faced unimaginable horrors, but their courage, their camaraderie, and their unwavering spirit became legend. Today, five of these Easy Company veterans rest in Arlington, a place of quiet reflection and immense national pride. Join us as we locate their headstones and share the stories of these extraordinary men. So grab your headphones, lace up your walking shoes, and prepare to be inspired. This is a journey of remembrance and a tribute to the Band of Brothers buried in Arlington National Cemetery. All right, Jen, so we know what we're talking about today.
Walk with History has done many videos from Arlington, and we are very now intimately familiar with the topography of Arlington. We know what areas you're going to cover, and basically, if you're going there to cover a certain topic, how you want to plan your day, because you can't be walking across the cemetery two or three times a day. In one visit, I would recommend not even walking across it in one visit. It is a massive space, and you really don't get any kind of vehicle access unless you have someone buried there. So you must walk, and it is hilly, and it is a lot of exercise. And if it's any time in the heat of the summer, it can be very tiring. So yeah.
What we have for those listening to this podcast episode, right? So on our YouTube channel, we've probably made maybe almost a dozen videos from Arlington. I've got a whole playlist, and I'll link that video playlist in the show notes of this podcast episode. But we've been there numerous times in almost every season and almost every condition, covered just some incredibly amazing people.
Yeah.
Actors and actresses, and obviously all veterans. We've done Arlington House.
We do John F. Kennedy, Tomb of the Unknown. So we do the big ones that you're going to see on like an original visit. And then we started to do more off the beaten path. So we got into the back of Arlington and some randoms, like when we did Gunny Ermey, he's way off on the right side in a new section. And so it was after we did Masters of the Air that took us to all the way back to the right, to the left section where we found Egan, that we started to go, well, what other series have people that could be buried at Arlington? And we really were like, Band of Brothers. We couldn't believe that we, A, hadn't done that, and B, really no one has.
Right. And because we've done Tuskegee Airmen, we've danced all around World War II, all throughout Arlington, and we don't know how we didn't cover the Band of Brothers, but you found out that there's five that are currently buried there.
They're currently buried there. And what's nice, I would say nice about the Band of Brothers is they're in really three sections that are pretty close together. So if you're going to visit the Band of Brothers in Arlington, you can see all of them relatively easily and quickly, which is nice.
Yeah. Now, one of the first ones that we're going to talk about here was actually featured in the miniseries relatively prominently.
we're going to talk about a more controversial character right off the get-go because he has a prominent part in the series. And he also was depicted inaccurately by Stephen Ambrose, who wrote the book in 1992. It's published. The show was made in 2001, right after 9/11. It airs. So it gets a lot of notoriety and camaraderie around the patriotism of the time. But Stephen Ambrose, who's a great scholar, really messes up on this person. And this person has a very prominent role in the series. So we're talking about Albert Blythe.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about when he was a private first class.
He was private first class with Easy Company, 2nd Battalion, 506 Parachute Infantry Regiment, and the 101st Airborne. He makes that initial jump on D-Day with the rest of Easy Company, the original men of Easy Company. And he gets separated from everybody. And he's depicted in the series as he gets separated and he's scared. He doesn't quite know what to do, so he just goes to sleep.
Sir, when I landed on D-Day, I found myself in a ditch all by myself. I fell asleep. I think it was those air sickness pills they gave us. When I woke up, I didn't really try to find my unit to fight. I just stayed put.
What's your name, Trooper?
Blythe, sir. Albert Blythe.
The nice thing about covering miniseries like this sometimes, or historical figures covered in miniseries, is you can cut in good examples. And so I actually cut in an example of him saying, in the miniseries, he wasn't explaining it to Dick Winters, it was someone else. And you can tell the way that they crafted for the miniseries, this character was someone who was afraid.
Yeah.
Right. He said, hey, when I landed on D-Day, I woke up and I was in my foxhole and I didn't go look for my company. I just laid there. And he's portraying someone who it's, you put in the category of coward, unfortunately.
I wanted to debunk that because I want people to understand, first of all, Blythe is coming from Philadelphia. He only went to 3 years of high school before he enlisted in the paratroopers. So he's 18, 19 years old when he's enlisting from his hometown. There's no cowardice here. He's what they call a misdrop. So a misdrop is, there was a number of paratroopers who didn't hit the target and got scattered out in different areas.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about one of the other Band of Brothers buried here talks about it in an interview, and we'll discuss that later on how that happens.
So you have to imagine to have trained with everybody to plan for D-Day and then this huge invasion of D-Day and then to get misdropped and lost. He teams up with other misdrops and they found the rest of Easy Company. But what you do in those initial moments is like scary because you're by yourself across enemy lines in France, occupied Nazi Germany. And you can understand like what he's saying is I didn't know what to do. So I went to sleep or I just stayed in my position and waited till other people found me. That's more of what he did. He basically just stood fast and he just waited. Now, they depicted in this, so I went to sleep. Like maybe he fell asleep, but it wasn't as if he was like, oh, I don't know what to do. I'm scared I'm gonna fall asleep. I'm gonna go to sleep.
And even in the show, he says, oh, I think it was the air sickness medicine. But I also found in an interview later where Dick Winters, mm-hmm. you know, in the interview says the same thing that you're saying is he debunks that. He's, listen, the miniseries was exaggerated.
Yes.
Right? And he goes on to say, let me tell you about this man.
I think the problem Winters had with this, and this is the problem that you and I both have with this, is he's not a coward. He is doing his duty. He did jump and he got lost. He got not by any fault of his own. He did find his group. He does continue to fight. You will see he's actually injured by a sniper. He does receive the Purple Heart. So what happens after he's reunited is it shows some kind of, he gets hysterical blindness, they call it. So it's basically like a temporary case of PTSD where you're just so overwhelmed by the stress of everything that your body reacts to stress.
And just shuts down.
We've talked about this a lot. Whether or not you want your body to react to stress, your body will react to stress.
The thing is there are certain things that you can train to, and there's certain things that you just can't. Yeah. A good example that always pops into my head is for mountaineers. Mm-hmm. Mountaineers, they can train to be in good physical condition, have good cardio, but until you actually get to altitude, we won't know until how your body's going to react to it. You can be in peak physical condition here at sea level, be a marathon runner and all this stuff and carry heavy packs. You get to altitude and your body just might not be able to handle it. And there's no conditioning around that. Yeah. So this is, to me, an example. Now, I think for the mini series, as we've talked about again in the past, they capture a bunch of what happens to other people and they tend to embody multiple examples of something into a character.
Yes.
I have a feeling that's what happened, because what he's kind of known for in this mini series is his interaction later with Dick Winters.
Yes, and that is true. So Winters goes to the infirmary for another reason. And as he's in the infirmary, he goes down the line to see his guys. And Blythe is one of them. And Blythe is having a case of temporary hysteria blindness. And Winters talks to him. And Winters basically levels with him, humanizes it, and tells him we're all scared, right? Even Winters admits, we're all scared. We all are not really knowing what we're doing. We're hoping training takes over. All of us are in this together. This is war. Winters even says it happens relatively quickly, where Blythe gets this understanding. He feels some camaraderie. He feels understood. I think he feels a little bit of a shared kinship there, which happens with soldiers, and starts to come out of it, because it is a physical ailment that is brought on by stress. And once you can start to alleviate that stress, or at least deal with the stress, the physical ailment heals itself. And so his hysterical blindness basically clears. And then he is part of a group that investigates a farmhouse days later. He's shot in the collarbone by a sniper. He recovers from the wound. He's awarded the Purple Heart. Now, the series will say that he never recovers from the wounds and dies in 1948. I have no idea where Stephen Ambrose got that, but most people say it's because no one ever really talked to Blythe again he's injured.
And I think Dick Winters said in that later interview, he mentioned that he got wounded and he said that they thought they had lost him.
Yeah.
So I'm connecting some dots based on what we've seen in your research, is that my assumption is that he was injured, right? Ended up surviving it, but the rest of Easy Company had already moved on. Mm-hmm. They didn't realize that he survived. Yeah. And then from there, I think he was probably shipped home.
Yeah, he was shipped home. He was released from the Army hospital in October 1945. So it's after the end of the war, and he basically loses touch with everybody. Now, he eventually will serve in Korea. He re-ups and serves in the Korea in the 187th Airborne, where he's awarded a Bronze Star and a Silver Star for jumping behind enemy lines surrounded by a Chinese battalion. He never gets to retire from military service because he dies at age 44 in December of 1967. So I think this is a perfect storm. Since Ambrose writes Band of Brothers, and it's published in 1992. He's doing his research in the 80s, publishing it. Blythe does die in the 60s, so he doesn't have to fact check Blythe's death, but Blythe is dead. So it works. And if you're not talking specifically to family or reaching out to family or finding people who knew him and remembered him, his writing that he died in 19, I don't know where the 1948 comes from, but his dying that he died in 1948 doesn't really get fact checked until the miniseries comes out.
And then, of course, he gets really popular
and his family sees it. And this is in the miniseries. It says it at the end. Blythe dies in 1948. His family will see this and be like, hold up. No, he's not. He has a wife, Kay. He has a son. Gordon, who will see this and talk about what really happened. On active duty in Germany, he felt nauseated, returned from a weekend at in Belgium. He had taken part in a commemorating ceremony of the Battle of the Bulge, and he was taken to the emergency department in Germany, where he was admitted with a perforated ulcer, and he dies in intensive care. And then he's buried at Arlington National Cemetery with full honors. So in Band of Brothers, it is depicted, unfortunately, it isn't accurate. The Blythe family comes out and it led to corrections in subsequent books of Band of Brothers. So if you have newer editions of Band of Brothers, it is corrected, but you will still see it in the original series. And we just want to honor Blythe because he was a hero. And some people will say he's depicted not as one. And I just want to make it clear, just because you suffer from hysteria blindness, or just because you suffer from some kind of PTSD, or just because you get separated from your group and you hold fast instead of taking on 1,000 German soldiers by yourself, does not make you a coward. You are doing your duty, you're doing your job, and you have to overcome challenges. And challenges don't just happen to you after your service. Your PTSD doesn't just happen to you after you're done. PTSD can happen during your time, during your service, as you're fighting. And if you overcome it then in the moment, you are still overcoming and you're still a hero. And so we wanted to honor Blythe. He's the first person I visited in Arlington. He's right by Robert Todd Lincoln. So most people will go see Robert Todd Lincoln. That is Lincoln's oldest son.
It's just like down the hill.
Just down the hill from it. And it's so very easy to find. And there's a path to Robert Todd Lincoln's sarcophagus. And so just right down the hill, you will see Blythe. I actually met other people there who were looking for Blythe. And I directed them to Egan from Masters of the Air. They didn't know Egan was there. And we took pictures. They were from Poland. And we talked for a little while. So Blythe is a visited person from Band of Brothers at Arlington, and he's an easy grave to find, and he's there waiting for you.
It was cool to be able to make that part of the video for him. Now, the next person we're going to talk about was actually part of the leadership portrayed in the show Band of Brothers. And this was Lieutenant Colonel Strayer, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, Robert Strayer. He was the battalion commander for a time over Easy Company. He supported making the show Band of Brothers, but he said it was hard for him to watch. He's depicted by actor Phil McKee. He is in charge of Easy Company, hands it over to Dick Winters.
Now, if you are a Band of Brothers fan and you remember the show, so picture there's, I don't know the name of the episode, but they are still in England and they are training, right? And it's the scene where some of the soldiers kind of trick Captain Sobel into cutting the fence of this farmer's field, right? One of the soldiers is yelling from behind some bushes, basically imitating like a major.
Connie, Sobel's lost again, right?
Yeah, he's lost.
Oh, hey, Lance.
Can you do Major what?
It's a wild bear crap in the woods, son.
Shit, shit. Make it a good mage, you can goose this smuck. Get us moving?
No, no way. I'm not. Oh, yeah, yes.
What are you talking
about? You got it. Come on. All right, just this once.
No, sir, it's here. You're full grid off.
Goddamn. Is there a problem, Captain Sobel?
Who said that? Who broke silence?
I think it's Major Horton, sir.
Major Horton, what is he? Did he join us?
I think maybe he's moving between the platoons, sir.
What is the goddamn hold up, Mr. Sobel?
A fence, sir. God, a barbed wire fence.
Oh, that dog just ain't gonna hunt. Now you cut that fence and get this goddamn platoon on the move.
Yes, sir.
And it flashes forward to Dick Winters seeing Sobel come up. They're completely lost and all this stuff.
You've done it now, Yanks. You've captured me. Would that be the enemy?
As a matter of fact, yes.
And then, again, it steps right into Sobel getting yelled at by then Major Strayer.
Who was the idiot who cut that man's fence?
I was ordered to, sir.
By who?
Major Horton, sir.
Major Horton?
Yes, sir.
Major Horton told you to do that?
Yes, sir.
Major Horton ordered you to cut the fence?
Yes, he did.
Major Horton is on leave.
And then you just, you see, it's that moment in a show where the antagonist gets his comeuppance. Mm-hmm. And that was one of those moments. And it was Major Strayer that was giving him the right act.
So he's in charge. So as a major in 1942, he's in command of the 2nd Battalion of the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne. In 1945, he's made executive officer of the 506th. And his position as the 2nd Battalion CO was filled by Major Richard Winters. So that he basically gets promoted and then Winters takes his job. During his service, he's going to earn 4 Bronze Stars, 1 Silver Star, and 1 Purple Heart. He's pretty badass too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think he's a good leadership example for Winters. I think Winters looks up to him definitely more. So, but he fills that role because he had a good example from Strayer on how to fill that role.
Yeah, and even in the miniseries, there's a couple scenes with Strayer talking to the colonel, right? And he has a little bit of the read on the rest of the company and the battalion on kind of like how the men see Strobel. So he's a little bit of that connection between the colonel who finally sends Strobel off to... he fires him without firing him. He's like, this is a promotion. It sends him off to go do, you know, to do training. And Major Strayer is right there. Yeah. Right. So again, if you remember that scene where Strobel is essentially quote unquote promoted, but he's sent off to run a training company. Yeah. Major Strayer is the third person in that scene. Yeah. It's the colonel and Strobel, but Major Strayer sitting there right off to the side. Doesn't have many lines, but he's right there. And that's how it would have been.
Yeah, so you and I relate a lot to this, right? Because we were both officers in the military. And I always talk about Dick Winters and what it takes to lead and then move up the rank politically as the leadership role gets more and more, I wouldn't say important,
but it's just difficult.
It's more difficult because you're overseeing more and more people, and then it's more and more political, and then it's more and more your decisions are very heavy at this point because they have lasting impact and they trickle down over a ton of your personnel. And that is where this is where Strayer is. And these are the hard decisions because even though you see Strobel and you're like, oh, he's a terrible leader, he does prepare his men better than any other leader because he makes them do all this physical activity to a fault, but they are so conditioned and ready for D-Day. And even though Strobel is not good with the leadership of taking any kind of criticism or learning from his mistakes, he really is one of those leaders who feels like they're right all the time and really rests on rank. And you still, as a leader of someone like that, you are still trying to teach and mentor them to be better. You don't just automatically kick them out or change, or you really do your best to try to help them learn from that. And unfortunately, in this situation, Strobel didn't. We're getting into battle. Time is of the essence, and they do make this quick leadership change. But you see how difficult it is, even for the leaders, to do this.
Yeah, and that's why I liked that you covered Strayer, because as someone who's more senior now, right, as you go up, you deal with like knuckleheads or even good soldiers and sailors that make knucklehead decisions. And so, if you think about it, Strayer dealt with Strobel when he cut the fence. He probably dealt with the NCOs during the kind of little mutiny, right? During when they said, "Hey, we're not going to follow this man," and the colonel's yelling at them. But you know that Strayer was the one that first got that word. I can just picture Strayer being like, "Seriously, come on, I don't want to deal with this." I can just picture him in between before the information got to the colonel.
Oh, I picture the colonel ripping Strayer apart.
Sure.
Before he rips apart the NCOs.
Yeah.
Right? He's going to, believe me, your higher ups are going to take it out first on the person next closest to them.
Yeah.
They don't take it out on...
Yes, Strayer probably got it first from
Strayer
the colonel.
Strayer got it first.
The colonel probably calmed down after Strayer took the initial shots. And then...
And your job.
Yeah, and that's part of it. So it was really neat to be able to cover him.
Yeah.
Because not one of the core characters, but part of the leadership. And then to see what he did after the fact was really cool.
Exactly. And just instrumental. Just another good leader. He's right beside the the main building of Arlington. So when you walk into Arlington, the main building that has the restrooms and the little
visitor center.
He's in the next section right beside it to the left. Very easy to walk to and very easy to find. He's buried there with his wife, Mildred. She's an army nurse. They marry in January 1942. And he retired from the army after the war. They settled down in Pennsylvania, and then they retired to Florida. He dies on December 18th, 2002. And so they're both at Arlington National Cemetery, and we thank them both for their service.
Now, the next person we're talking about here is not quite as much out there on him, but I believe he was I don't know if he was part of the original Easy Company, but he is buried in Arlington, and he did serve with Easy Company.
So Arthur Mazerall, there isn't a lot on him. He's hard to find information on, but he is part of the original. And he's born in 1924. So if he's making the jump in 1944, he's 20 years old. So these guys are so young.
That's crazy.
He's born in Maine. And he was a paratrooper. He marries Wanda. Together they have Georgette and Hope. He dies on June 11th, 1988, and he's buried in Arlington National Cemetery.
And that's one of the things that I liked about the miniseries overall was obviously you have the central figures, right? The main characters that everybody knows. But they are really a representation of everybody else that was there that wasn't written about, that wasn't, you know, didn't have journals that they could be read and this, that, and the other. So for soldiers like Mazerall, they are a representation because he was right there with them during the war.
Yeah, he was like, it even says on his tombstone, the 101st Airborne. I always like the ones that are simple, right? So I appreciate that about it as well. He's 63 years old when he dies, and he dies in Arlington, Virginia. So he must have ended up there for his retirement. Even though he is from Maine, but he has, looks like he has two daughters, Georgette and Hope, and there's not much else on him, but we want to recognize him as one of Easy Company's 101st.
Our next figure that we're about to talk about, actually, he was on the show, but he portrayed himself. So he was in some of the interviews.
Yeah. So Forrest Guth, they had planned to put him as a character in the show. And they actually made a uniform because I guess his uniform was more specific to him. He put a lot of pockets on his uniform because I guess he liked to have a lot of things on him, carry a lot of things on him. And as most people know in the military, you can individualize your uniform to a point, especially in combat.
Yeah, especially in combat, especially, I mean, when you're spending years away from home, you're going to customize your stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you can think about the SEALs do it all the time, yeah. Even today.
And he was interesting because not only did he have some kind of brief spots in interviews during the miniseries, but he stuck around long enough that I actually found some other interviews done with him that I found on YouTube that I was able to cut into our video and him talking about, he must have been some sort of like engineer. He worked in an engineering plant because he talked about how he could have been deferred. He was working for the like a defense industry company, but then him and some of his friends in his hometown were like, you know what, we should join up, let's go join the 101st Airborne because I think they're getting paid $50 more a month, so we're going to join up with them.
Yeah, he's very money driven.
Yeah,
which at a young age you would be. He's a part of the original guys in Georgia. He's in Aldeborn, our video from there, so he'll be there as well. What his ability to do that makes him so special is he has this ability to modify and repair weapons. He was able to make his M1 rifle fully automatic.
Really?
Yeah. So that's where his engineering brain comes in. And that's why he is became a member of the armor for his comrades. His uniform was unique. He sewed on the extra pockets to carry extra equipment and ammunition.
And you said that he was one of two. The other was a character that was in the miniseries, was Shifty Powers, mm-hmm. who was like an expert sharpshooter.
Yes.
Yeah.
They were the only two who got expert. So if you and I both know, if you see ribbons and you get your rifle qual and your pistol qual, sometimes you'll see an S on the ribbon, which means you're a sharpshooter, but sometimes you'll see an E on the ribbon, which means you're an expert.
Yeah. And typically, especially in companies like this, if you got only two of your soldiers were expert marksmen, they're going to be doing some of that work.
Yeah.
That was, you're going to jump in behind enemy lines. And if you need a sharpshooter, you're going to grab your two experts.
And if you can make your weapon fully automatic.
That's cool.
Which means he doesn't have to reload as quick. To make your sharpshooter have an auto, that it just puts you ahead of the game. So that's why he has the extra pockets. When you think about it, he's carrying the extra equipment and doing things like that. He made his first combat jump into Normandy on June 6, 1944.
If I remember correctly, he gets injured.
Yes.
And I think he gets sent home.
He jumped into Operation Market Garden on September 17th, 1944, and he was injured during the landing because of a parachute malfunction. He's taken to an army hospital in England. He rejoins Easy Company in France before they're transported to Bastogne and to fight in the Battle of the Bulge. So he is with them.
So he comes back.
He comes back.
Okay.
And he's selected for the patrol mission, led by Sergeant Ken Mercer, because of his German-speaking ability. And he won a 30-day furlough to return to the States. And then the war ended before he could rejoin his unit. So he just has a lot going for him. He can speak German.
He's got that engineering brain.
He's got an engineering brain, and he's an expert marksman. So he enrolls in college when he's done. He gets a master's degree. He becomes a teacher in Norfolk, Virginia.
Which is where we're recording this.
And that's where we're recording this. And that's where he meets his wife, Harriet. They marry in 1949. They move to Delaware. He becomes an electronics teacher at a high school there. And then he dies in August in Delaware. Because he does interpret the German at one point. But his role is replaced by another actor in the episode Last Patrol. But that was him who really did that interpretation.
Oh, okay.
And we just want to honor him because it just goes to show you all these skills you have that really can be helpful in war. Speaking the language, being a good marksman.
Well, and to our point earlier, he was another misdrop. So he talks about in his later interview, it was 60s or 70s, something like that, that got posted on YouTube about he's recounting his experience for D-Day. And he's talking about seeing the tracers. He's talking about hearing bullets hitting the wings of his plane, watching another plane go down. And then he says that even he landed 2 miles from where he was supposed to meet with his company. And it was because these B-17 or whatever they were, whatever the aircraft were that they were jumping out of, the pilots were still relatively new as well. And so instead of going much slower, they were going about twice the speed that they should have been flying. Yeah. So they flew too far. Yeah. So when the green light went on and everybody jumps out of the plane, they're two miles away.
So that nervousness of war, right? And so that's what he's talking about, that even though D-Day was planned so specifically, that because they went faster, then I think they were supposed to go like 45 knots.
He said 75, but they were doing 150.
Yeah, they went double. 75 knots, they went 150. And because of that, they landed 2 miles off course. And to land 2 miles off course as an individual with no protection and then trying to find the rest of your crew.
And he does.
Which he does. But to go 2 miles in enemy territory, which all the pockets with all the ammunition on him, which means it's heavier, which means he's going to have to, it's almost like rucking at that point, but he does it. So he talks about that. So I just think he's just an unsung hero. Again, that skill set that comes into play, and then to live in Norfolk, Virginia, I think I shout that out in the video since we're here as well.
Yeah, you definitely do. Now, the last person that we covered for this video goes by the last name of Taylor. He was interesting because he was an NCO, if I remember correctly. And I believe you even had mentioned that he had taken part in the, when the NCOs went to the colonel and said, hey, we're not going to follow Sobel. He as a person wasn't really portrayed in the show, but he was one of those NCOs.
He is. So we're talking about Tech Sergeant Amos Buck Taylor. Now, I want to reiterate, these last couple graves are all in Section 60. So there's really only 3 sections you have to go to in Arlington to see them all. Like I said, Blythe is by Robert Todd. Strayer is right to the left. I think it's section 54. And then section 60 is these last 3, which is, again, 60 is one of our most visited sections. It's a large section. It's an active section. It's a more recent section. So if you're out in Section 60, more than likely you are going to see people visiting graves. And that's what Taylor is as well. But he is an NCO of Easy Company. And he is a part of the original 140 Men. His life story is featured in a 2009 book, We Who Are Alive and Remain, The Untold Stories of Band of Brothers. Because he is part of this whole original group, he has this interaction with Sobel because he goes AWOL from the training at Fort Benning. He goes AWOL to meet his Elaine, who he later will marry. And his three-day pass is canceled by Sobel. And he will marry her, and he was supposed to marry her then, but his three-day pass gets canceled, and then he has to marry her later. And then he has opinions about Sobel. He says that he never hated him. He thought he could be unfair, and he could not be trusted for battle situations. And because of that, he's one of the NCOs that participate in the mutiny in England. So he is depicted in the show as just one of the characters, but he doesn't really have a distinct name and everything like that. But just know that he's one of those guys. He does make that initial jump, his first combat jump on D-Day. He's one of the misdrops. He finds the other three after landing, and then they join their own unit 3 or 4 days later. He's wounded after the Battle of Carentan. He's evacuated to hospital in England. That's where he lost his camera that he brought with him to Normandy, which is too bad. In September of 1944, he makes another jump for Operation Market Garden, which eventually failed. And then while Easy Company is defending the island, he participates in Operation Pegasus in October of 1944. And after Easy Company has been relieved, he gets involved in a traffic accident. He fought in the Battle of the Bulge. It's him and another man who find and kill the German soldier that shot Walter Gordon. And then in January 1945, Taylor's shot in the leg and sent to an aid station. That wound was serious, and he spends 11 months in the hospital, and then he is discharged from the army. He marries Elaine in 1945 while still at the rehab hospital. Her dress, which I love, is made from Taylor's white silk reserve chute. So I love it. A couple women did this. They would make their wedding dresses from that white reserve shoot. So their second shoot is made of that white silk. And because silk was difficult to get during the war, it's one of those ration materials. Women didn't have this material available to them to make their wedding dresses. So she makes her wedding dress from his reserve shoot, which I think is just so beautiful.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool. You called that out in the video.
He's discharged in December and he works for the VA. He joins the CIA. He spends 25 years with the CIA. So we don't know what he did. They live in Sewell's Point for 30 years. They moved to Orange City in 2010. And then he passes away in 2011, 18 days after his wife. So I mentioned that too in the video. So he's just one of those characters that I almost don't know if he's not depicted because of his work with the CIA.
Oh, interesting.
Because he's important.
Yeah.
And he did some important things that could be played by a character. But because of his work with the CIA, it's almost like maybe you shouldn't focus on me and my life just so people aren't digging more into my background.
Yeah, interesting.
It seems, I don't know. We have friends that kind of work in that area. And it seems the longer they work in that area, the more they pull their social media stuff or their life away. So I wonder about that a little bit. But I just think he's awesome. And we just wanted to remember him. So those are the five men from Easy Company that are in Arlington National Cemetery. So if you wanted to visit them, they are a very easy group of men to visit. You could do it on one day. You could do it as you go to Tomb of the Unknown and Robert Kennedy. Those are what people usually see when they go to Arlington. And you can see the five Band of Brothers as well, which would be relatively easy to do. So it was an honor for us to do it. I think it's awesome to remember them and remember the series. And the series, it always goes up and down with its popularity. And I think as Masters of the Air come out, people revisit Band of Brothers. So it just was awesome for us to be there.
Well, that brings us to the end of our visit to Arlington National Cemetery and our exploration of the lives of the Easy Company soldiers laid to rest there. Their bravery and sacrifice during World War II helped shape the world we live in today. Their stories serve as a powerful reminder of the resilience of the human spirit in the face of unimaginable adversity. Before you go, I want to leave you with a thought. Easy Company wasn't just a military unit, it was a brotherhood. These men fought for each other, relied on each other, and formed an enduring bond that transcended war. Their unwavering loyalty and commitment to one another is a message that continues to resonate today. So let's honor their memory, not just by remembering their wartime achievements, but also by carrying forward that spirit of camaraderie in our own lives. Thank you for listening to the Talk With History podcast, and please reach out to us at our website, talkwithhistory.com. But more importantly, if you know someone else that might enjoy this podcast, shoot them a text and tell them to look us up. We rely on you, our community, to grow, and we appreciate you all every day. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.